Good morning and welcome to this January 25th, 2017 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'll give you more information on how to access those later in the show. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors, not only about their books, but about writing process, creativity, craft. These days, why writing is so important, why artists are so important, all the things that make make art art, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. This morning, it's a little poetry, essay, aphorisms, as well as science fiction. We're going to do a little of it all. It's my pleasure to welcome Sarah Manguso in the second half. Debut novelist and veteran screenwriter Ilan Mastai will be on with his novel All Are Wrong today, so stay tuned for that. But first, Sarah. Sarah Manguso is the author of 7 books, including Ongoingness, which is a meditation on motherhood and time, The Guardians, which is an investigation of friendship and suicide, The Two Kinds of Decay, a memoir about her experience with chronic autoimmune disease, and Hard to Admit and Harder to Escape, a collection of very short stories. She's also the author of 2 collections of poetry. She's received a lot of acclaim for those. She teaches all over. Her essays appear all over. 300 Arguments is her most recent. It's published by Grey Wolf, and we're going to chat about that and more this morning. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Marie.
Thanks so much. So I was mentioning offline that I first heard the book, and I heard you read from the book last summer at the Tin House Writers Workshop. And I found myself then just wanting to write everything down you were saying, because every sentence sounded like the smartest thing I'd ever heard. And then couldn't write that fast, so I realized I'd have to wait until February, and here it is. So now we're here. It's all written down for me, but I'll say, you know, there was really a great value in hearing you read aloud. It's also great to have it in front of me so I can read it. But I thought maybe the best way to introduce this book is just to have you read the first page so that our listeners can kind of get a little taste for what we're talking about here.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the first page has 3 of the 300 arguments. A great photographer insists on writing poems. A brilliant essayist insists on writing novels. A singer with a voice like an angel insists on singing only her own terrible song. So when people tell me I should try to write this or that thing I don't want to write, I know what they mean. You might as well start by confessing your greatest shame. Anything else would just be exposition. It can be worth foregoing marriage for sex, and it can be worth foregoing sex for marriage. It can be worth foregoing parenthood for work, and it can be worth foregoing work for parenthood. Every case is orthogonal to all the others. That's the entire problem.
I love it. You know, it occurred to me when I first read this, I've read it a couple of times, that the first page really introduces a lot of what you unpack throughout the rest of it, which is writing, a writer's life, what you should be writing versus what, you know, you do write, maybe shame and parenthood and sex and marriage, that these first big themes kind of appear at the beginning and then, you know, kind of get sorted through and unpacked throughout the rest of it, throughout the other 297 aphorisms. And I thought, you know, it works so well to read this through 1 to 300, and it also works so well to pick it up and flip through it and look for what you need when you need it.
Oh, thank you. I spent probably most of the composition time trying to put them in some kind of order, which I had a little bit of experience with, having put together a couple of poetry collections. So there are, you know, 40 or 60 pieces in those. But in putting 300 things in order, I found myself really second-guessing a lot of my choices. And it was almost toward the end of the production process that I finally began to listen to people who were telling me that alphabetical order isn't really the best way, Sarah. So for a long time, I just had them alphabetically by first word or first phrase, and anything other than that seemed hopelessly arbitrary to me. But ultimately, I grouped them thematically. The ones about the self are at the beginning, and then they go through others about desire and work and art and failure, which is, I think, the book's secret subject.
It's it is very interesting to me, the arc of our areas of concern throughout life, that, you know, in our teens and 20s, we're so fixated on, well, A, on ourselves, but also on, you know, sex and dating. And then in our 30s, it kind of falls away to work and parenthood and marriage. And, you know, as we age, it's obviously mortality. And the book gives you kind of this experience, gives you this narrative arc of a life lived. I think there's a wonderful aphorism in there about, you know, I'm going to butcher it, but essentially I look at people who are younger than me and think, you know, how can you not know what's coming? And it's, you know, similar to the way people older than me look at me. And you just really have this wonderful experience of time, I think.
Yeah, and the old people look at me. That's actually one of my favorites. I know I'm not supposed to pick favorites, but I do have a few that I feel encapsulate what I really wanted to write about, which was exactly as you said. It's a book about arriving at midlife, getting intimate with failure and thwarted ambition and obsolete desires. And the book makes the case that these aren't necessarily bad things. They aren't necessarily bad experiences to have.
Yeah. I know that you have been a record keeper your whole life. Ongoingness was there's been a lot of writing about diaries, the importance of diaries in your life. And it's funny to me that at this moment in our national life, I have become more compelled to write things down because, you know, when truth is now being called into question and down is suddenly up, I've found myself wanting to write things down that I know are right for myself and you know, truths. And I wonder if there will be a kind of some movement towards people wanting to record things for themselves and to say, this is what we're living through right now. And this is so unprecedented. I don't know if there will be a more turn toward journaling and diarying.
I think there will be. I have, well, probably much like you, I've been spending much too much time on the political blogs, but particularly it's been extremely helpful to me to read accounts of people who have lived through totalitarian regimes led by dictators, led by demagogues, particularly Masha Gessen, who left the USSR when she was a teenager and now lives in America and is, I think, one of our most important political commentators. Mm-hmm. She has recommended everybody two things. One, to just do exactly as you just said, to bear witness to what's going on so we can be sure that we can trust our eyes and ears over some representative who will teach you, or representative of Trump, I should say, who instruct us, you know, not to believe our lying eyes, but to believe instead whatever propaganda they're churning out at whatever rate. Marsha Gessen also recommended that everybody make a list of things that you would never do and to consult it frequently. That's a sort of a very eerie, sort of quietly horrifying instruction. And she recommended that we start with, you know, will I turn my neighbors in if it comes to that, which is then again, citizen. So, yes, I think absolutely in at least two different ways, making an account now is as important as it's ever been.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, it's a different exercise, I think, to write things down in order to remember versus to write things down, as you say, in order to tell yourself what your future, what your current self expects of your future self in light of what's going on, and record keeping versus like promise keeping, right? Or
that's
interesting.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's go ahead.
Oh no! It's remembering versus reminding, but I guess reminding is a kind of remembering. It's remembering what you want for yourself. But then that just becomes an academic argument about time. That's something I'm going to have to think more about clearly.
Yeah, I think that through all the ash and destruction here, there's going to be so much opportunity for some amazing writing and art to come out of this. And, you know, it's way too soon, obviously, to predict what's going to happen. But I do see this as a call to arms and, just an amazing time for artists to, to rally. Rally and resist, but B, also to make some incredible observations. I mean, we really have been shaken out of our, inner contemplative time to look outward. And I think that will produce something incredible, really.
Yes, I agree. Many artists do work well under extreme duress. But there are others who work well under less duress, I guess.
Yeah.
It feels wrong to look at masterworks like Olivier Messiaen's music that he wrote while he was in a concentration camp and say, you know, if he weren't in a concentration camp, we wouldn't have Symphony for the End of Time. it all kind of worked out. But, at the same time, I think there's a really difficult relationship between political duress and great art.
Yeah. First of all, it's hard to have the time and concentration right now. I mean, it's really very hard to focus on anything other than this. So, I kind of hope at some point the noise dies down so that we can at least focus again. Because it's, when you're in a hyper state of anxiety all the time, you can't work.
That's true. I don't expect things to get better, though. Maybe I shouldn't say that out loud. But,
no, I know.
I know.
Getting back to the book, which I really want to spend our time talking about, is one thing that I marvel at in here, and I think it goes to our broader political discussion as well, is how you are able to capture such intimacy while also retaining your privacy. You know, when you finish the book, you realize, I don't know a lot of specific things about Sarah, but the book is so very intimate. And that's a trick. I don't know if you can speak to it, but it's really incredible to be that close to somebody.
Good. Yeah. You've posed the question in a way that's different from the way that I usually hear it, which is if you write autobiographically so much, if you've written, 3, maybe this is another memoir, maybe 4 memoirs, why aren't you on Facebook? Or, why if your medium is yourself, your life, the uninteresting and interesting parts of your life. If you make art about that, then why aren't you on Facebook if your whole project is just divulging and divulging? And the answer, obviously is, the project is not just to divulge and divulge, as you put it. It's just to divulge exactly what I want in the way that I want.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not surprised that you feel that I haven't just kind of, dumped my bag out on the table. I'm not writing a memoir in order to release all the information. I'm writing a memoir in order to try to make sense of something that happened to me. Each of my books is about a particular problem, and I treat it very much as a writing project. It's not really a divulging project. It's a project that requires that I find a form to contain this problem, and in so doing, get to the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's something that you mentioned, Ongoingness, which is my previous book, the one about diary keeping and parenthood. One of the last edits that I made to that book was to remove all of the proper nouns from it. It's a very short book, made of short sections, and I felt that the few proper nouns in the book were really getting in the way of producing the effect that I wanted. I felt that the proper nouns were very loud. So I took out, there's the name of an island, there's the name of a cathedral, there's the name of a cave with cave paintings inside. There are the names of a couple of different people. There's the name of a horse. And I took them out. So you're not getting that information, but I would argue strongly that the information, the effect that I wanted, I was able to achieve only after I removed those facts.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I do really connect with this idea, and I think it might be helpful for listeners who are either writers or just living through the world as writing as a way to understand and as a way to alleviate anxiety and depression. And I do think that trying to make visual sense of things is a wonderful self-soothing and kind of necessary way to order the world or, you know, way to order your brain. It really does help to get stuff out of your head and down onto the page where you can kind of, you know, physically manipulate it in a way that, you know, your brain will just spin out of control. But words kind of give an order and a semblance to things that make it easier to understand.
Definitely. And it's also a kind of containment because speaking for myself, before I try to distill a feeling or a fear or a thought into the most efficient prose that I can, it feels not only shapeless but sizeless. It feels almost infinite, you know. And so the fear, or at least this is my sort of mildly insane fear. I fear that just about every thought or experience or feeling that I have is broad and deep enough to just engulf me. But once I put it into prose, it becomes much more manageable. It becomes small, contained.
Yes, right, right. I also wanted to touch on motherhood because I think you, a lot of your writing has touched on something that certainly has been reflected in all of the women's marches and this pull between, you know, if I choose motherhood, am I foregoing work? What does it mean to, you know, give myself over to this other person for a while I still want to create art? And there's some really wonderful aphorism passages in here about that struggle. And what motherhood now means in light of where the world is, I think, is also really changing. What we teach our children, what we teach our daughters, what we give of them that maybe we had taken for granted a year ago that we are now called upon to give them. And I wonder, as you have now lived in motherhood and lived in writing, I don't know, your thoughts on that duality, if you feel like you are a richer artist, a richer writer for it, if you feel like it has taken something essential away from your art, whatever your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, well, so far, yes to absolutely everything you've said. all of those contradictory questions. All of those things feel true. Yeah. I've been writing about motherhood and its intersection with art making since long before I became a mother. One of the central anxieties of my life when I was younger was how anybody could possibly be a parent and be the kind of artist that I thought I wanted and needed to be. That, you know, I should say no. The kind of artist that I wanted and needed to be was one who was absolutely enthralled to the need to write, and for whom writing and reading and thinking and working and found contemplation was absolutely my first priority at all times, every day, every year. And it really wasn't until I, started becoming. It started thinking concretely about this problem, and by looking civically at artists who had produced work that I deemed great, who had been parents, and you know, I should say, you know, not just parents but mothers. And for a long time, I said sort of, you know, self-consciously trying to be funny. I thought, you know, I could be a pretty great dad and still be the kind of writer that I want to be. But I don't know if I can be a mother. I don't know if I can be a good enough mother to be the kind of artist that I want to be, the kind of do the kind of work that I seem to be continuing to do, which is all consuming. And I wrote an essay about this. It's not published in any of my books, but it came out in Harper's. It's called The Grand Shattering. And it's about that civic fear. And it's also about what happened after I decided to become a mother and what happened after I was a mother. I was, in some way, I had this apparently pretty irrational fear that the moment that I gave birth, I would then sort of have to transfer my identity from writer to mother. I couldn't even conceive of those roles intersecting or even taking turns, I guess, as being the primary component of my identity. And it really took having an actual child and living with this situation, just being a mother for a year or a couple of years before I realized that fear was it's extremely irrational, and happily, it really had nothing to do with what I found the actual experience of motherhood to be, which was certainly an all consuming activity, but very, very interesting. Yeah. I had no idea that I would find it so interesting, and so all of a sudden there's just a wealth of material that I'd never considered before. I'd never written about before, that I'd never thought about before. And I'm not talking about how cute babies are and how tired I was. there are some things about time and memory and identity and communication that I learned from being a mother to a baby and to a young child. And I absolutely, to come around finally to answering your question, I absolutely believe that my work is the better for my having become a mother. Mm-hmm. There are, of course, many disclaimers to add, which is that, some of which are, I have health insurance, I am white, I am employed, my child is neurotypical, I have only one child, I have to support a spouse, and on and on and on. And all of those things very, very much contribute to the environment within which being a mother has not utterly destroyed my ability to be a writer.
Right, right. It's funny because my only relationship with thinking about being a mother before I was a mother was babysitting. And so I thought, well, babysitting's a full-time job. Like, when you're babysitting, you can't do anything else. That's just what you're doing. And so if you're a mother and you're doing that 24/7, where is the space? And of course, you're right. I mean, it really feels like there's something essential to being a human being about mothering that what an experience to miss out on if you didn't do it. It's certainly not for everyone, but something you said in there.
I mean, I have to take this too, because I don't believe that being a mother is in some way compulsory for making the best art that you can make. I mean, it really is just here's one answer or here's one contradiction. Virginia Woolf. Okay, so we have that,
yeah.
And certainly, there are men who make amazing work who are or aren't parents. There are women who make amazing work who are or aren't parents. There are people of, every conceivable gender who are making great work who are not parents, who have other extreme demands on their time that in their way make a kind of, I think, provide a similar kind of desperation to make the work and a desperation to not be interrupted. People who care for other people who are not their progeny, people who care for older people who care for friends, people who have pets, people who have all-consuming jobs. In my essay, The Grand Shattering, I made the argument that all of these experiences, all of these extreme experiences, I think, are up to a certain point very, very good for the artist's mind and heart. It's good to be pulled in different directions. It's good to have a reason to need to write this stuff down. It doesn't necessarily need to be, the experience of being a mother.
Sure.
Although for me, it has been very fruitful.
Yes.
Pardon my pun.
Sure, sure. Yeah, very good point. Very good point. My guest this morning is Sarah Manguso. I've forgotten to even breathe and make announcements during this half hour because it's gone too fast and there's too much to talk about. But huge pleasure to have Sarah Manguso, 300 Arguments. Before we totally run out of time, I would just love you to talk a little bit about living in the world as an artist. Does it mean, kind of carrying a notebook around? There's some really great aphorisms in here that just have people's quotes of observations that you've heard people say in a Starbucks or heard a father say to a child. So tell me just like how you live in the world as a writer. Is there always a notebook? Are you always observing people closely on subways and grocery store lines? How do you move in the world as an artist?
Well, that way of moving in the world is always changing. I used to have a little book, and I would write in it, pen on paper. This is the olden days. And now I can be a little bit more surreptitious. I can take my phone out, and I use a notes application, and I write things down. But I write much less down now than I used to. And I find that, there is a lot of comfort in my knowledge now that if I hear something really good, I'm likely to remember it in some form that becomes useful to me later. Oh. And I'm also going to forget a whole lot of what I see. And I have to believe that forgetting is just as important to the process as remembering.
Mm. I love that. I do think that's right, that the, silence is just as important as words sometimes. And what's not on the page is sometimes speaks more than what is on the page. And that's a really a point well taken. Was
that's,
this always...
That's absolutely it.
Yeah, yeah. Was this always 300 arguments, or was it like 498 that you had to whittle down, or 206 that you had
hardly.
To beef up?
No, it was. Well, it was a product of procrastination. I was working on another book, what I conceived of as a big book about whiteness in class in Boston, and I started writing these as a bad habit on the side. And when I had about 100 of them, I thought, okay, I'm going to have to. This habit isn't going away, so I set myself the goal of writing 200, and it was astonishingly easy to get to 200. And then I thought, okay, well, let's do 300. And then it was so much harder to write those last 100 to get up to 300 than it had been to write the first 200. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, okay, maybe I can make a book of it. And so, as I said, putting them in order took a long time. But then the book was done, and I thought I would go back to this Boston book, but instead I immediately started writing more arguments. I have about 100 now. Who knows what I'll do with them in the future. Hmm. I hope I write the Boston book someday.
Me too. I hope you do too. Sarah Manguso, I wish we had 5 more hours because there's so much to talk about, but we're out of time. But I'll have you back on. I'll wait.
Thank you so much, Rory.
Me too. Thanks so much. That was Sarah Manguso. The book is 300 Arguments. It is out and available now. Really, really a pleasure. We're going to take a very short break. Please stay with me. Ilan Mastai will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You always can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. We have direct downloads. I have 20 years of shows up there, hundreds and hundreds of shows. We have information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events at the Scape Gallery, and more. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I am so pleased to be joined this morning by Elon Mastai, a Canadian screenwriter and novelist. He is best known for The F Word, which won the Canadian Screen Award for Best Adapted Screenplay at the Second Canadian Screen Awards in 2014. His other screenwriting credits include MVP, Most Vertical Primate, and Fury. But it's his novel, All Are Wrong Today, is published by Dutton, that we'll be chatting about this morning. Although I can't promise that screenwriting won't come up, but primarily we'll be talking about this awesome, awesome novel. Elon, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. This was a fun book. You know what? I need a book on time travel right now. If this could come to pass, it would be would be fantastic. So nobody introduces a book better than the writer. So I'm going to give you a chance to talk about All Are Wrong Today, is kind of where the idea sprung from, and kind of take us into this world.
Sure. When I set out to write the novel, of course, I wanted to write something where the journey of both the character and the reader is on, you know, where you start and where you end are so far apart, and it's such an unexpected journey, and there's so many twists and turns. But that, of course, makes it a little difficult to sum up.
So yeah, right.
I mean, the book opens in the present day in 2016, but it's the 2016 that people in the 1950s and 60s thought we were going to have. This sort of techno-utopian future with flying cars and, you know, robot maids and teleportation and, you know, hotels on the moon and all this sort of stuff, all this sort of, like, giddy technology that the post-war generation was certain was right around the corner. In this book, it all came to pass. But then my protagonist, Tom, through a series of unfortunate circumstances, including a stolen time machine, finds himself stranded in what appears to him to be a terrifying dystopia, but which we immediately recognize is just the real world, like the world we live in. So he finds himself stranded in our 2016, which seems to him to be a place where everything has gone horribly wrong and humanity has taken some strange wrong turn. He, of course, wants to get back to what he feels is the way the world is supposed to be, but, of course, as he gets to know our world, but also, and more specifically, the people in his life, these very different versions of his family, the woman he, you know, has this romantic connection with, and even himself, he starts to question just what kind of life he's really supposed to have. So that's sort of the, I mean, it goes, there's a lot of plot twists and turns and character reveals and all kinds of stuff that happens beyond that, but that's the basic premise of the book. It sort of came from both a recent thing and a very sort of distant kind of childhood thing for me. More recently, you know, just that observation, which I'm sure a lot of people are making, that there's, you know, the idea of dystopia is very prevalent in our popular culture right now. And that's, you know, putting aside wherever you stand on the political spectrum. There's a lot of dystopia in our books, in our TV and movies, in our, you know, video games, just generally in the pop culture. And it didn't always used to be like that. You know, over the last few decades, there's been a real turn from utopia to dystopia. And, and a more recent thing was just me looking around and thinking to myself, well, what if somebody came here and felt this was the dystopia? Where would they come from, and what would be their observations? When I was a kid, my grandfather, who was born in New York City, and he was a chemist and a scientist. He had this really extensive collection of old vintage science fiction from the 50s and 60s, all these old paperbacks and anthologies. And as a kid in the 80s, I loved them, you know. I mean, even though the covers were all brittle and kind of creased and they were well read, I loved to take them off the shelf and stare at these, like, garishly painted covers with these sort of, like, wild imaginings of the future. But even then, I knew there was a disconnect. The future wasn't turning out the way these writers and artists in the 40s and 50s and 60s imagined. And I was really interested in that. You know, what happened to the future we were supposed to have? And I think part of it was in 1986. So I was born. My mom's from Chicago. My granddad is from New York City, so they're American, but I was born in Vancouver in Canada. And in 1986, we had Expo 86, which was actually the last World's Fair ever hosted in North America. Mm. And, of course, the sort of aesthetic of the World's Fair, you know, in the 64 Fair in New York and the 67 Expo in Montreal, were very much a part of this sort of techno-utopian vision of a future where technology would solve all of humanity's problems. And in Vancouver, it was sort of, in a lot of ways, even though for me I didn't think about it like that as a kid, it was sort of the last gasp of this optimistic futurism here in North America. We haven't had a World's Fair here since 1986. Huh. And so I think I was just I was just thinking a lot about this stuff, and I was very aware of it as a kid. And then growing up in Vancouver after that, it was sort of like growing up in sort of the rubble of this futurism. There was this, you know, a lot of the expo grounds got like abandoned, and there was this like decades long plan that took until we had the Olympics in Vancouver just a couple years ago to really actually do something with these abandoned lands. Some of it was still used. For example, they built a monorail for the expo, and that's still like the Vancouver subway system is like this futuristic monorail, which is kind of hilarious. But, you know, I was very aware of this disconnect. It was just all around me. I didn't have the critical faculties as a kid to really be thinking about it. But, that kind of connection between the stuff that interested me as a kid, the influence of my grandfather and just what was happening in the city I was growing up in, and then this sort of modern, you know, sort of more contemporary thinking about how our ideas of the future have changed sparked the idea. And so it occurred to me that if somebody came to our world, somebody from my grandfather's generation was spat out in 2016, what they would think of what the future became.
Right, right, right. You know, the interesting thing about writing science fiction, and I don't know if your screenplays deal in the science fiction realm, but I think they're more like romantic comedies, right? I mean, they're not sci-fi.
Yeah, I mean, I've written a bunch of different genres, but I write a lot of romantic comedy, yeah, and my most recent movie was a film called What If, which was out about 2 years ago, and with Daniel Radcliffe and Adam Driver and Zoe Kazan, mm-hmm. and that was a romantic comedy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the world of science fiction, the hard part of writing it seems like, is establishing all the rules, because, you know, once the world doesn't look exactly like it does now, you kind of have to inform the reader, and you do such a brilliant job of that throughout this book, of giving us enough clues, but it doesn't get bogged down in, you know, here's what this looks like, you know, the rules of the world are very clear.
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, the first person narrator was probably the biggest key to that, because that's exactly what you're describing is exactly what I didn't want. It took me a while to actually, as a screenwriter, so screenplays are written in the third person. They're always written in the third person. It's a very specific, very lean, laconic, third person present tense writing style. That's just how they're written. You write what the audience will see on screen as if it's happening on the page. So I think that was just my kind of comfort zone. But I didn't want that kind of gee whiz, sort of like awestruck, dazzled, kind of like taking you through and explaining everything to you and how wonderful it's going to be and all this sort of elaborate detail. Because if you lived in that version of the world, you wouldn't feel that way about it. You know, it would just be your everyday. Just like, you know, I mean, we all walk around with these sort of supercomputers in our pocket. You know, anybody's cell phone, even your crappiest cell phone, would still have been the most powerful computer on the planet 15 years ago. But of course, we don't think about that. We don't stare at it all awestruck. We wonder why our Wi-Fi connection isn't as good as it should be and why our apps, you know, aren't working. You know, so you tend to be a lot more nonchalant about technology. And so that sort of self-effacing, witty but sort of casual, first-person narration was kind of key for that.
Right. Absolutely. The other interesting thing that came, you know, I'm always kind of more drawn to character than drawn to background, and you know, I zero in on character more than I zero in on plot. And so the issues of identity in this, I think, are really fascinating. And what makes identity? What makes somebody who they are? Is it their experience? Is it their genetics? Is it their... and this really gave you a lot of room to play that, you know, if I was born into this world with these sets of circumstances, with these parental influences, I would look like this versus, you know, if circumstances were different, I'd look like this. And I wonder how much fun you had with that, how much identity played on your mind, and talk a little bit about these characters and playing around with them.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely, and you're very astutely kind of honing in the whole point of writing the book. I mean, obviously, all this fun technology and sort of imagining what the present would look like in an alternate history if things had gone differently in, you know, the 60s is fun, but it's not really worth writing a book about to me. What's worth writing a book about is because you have a story to tell about a character or a collection of characters. You know, character is the reason to actually tell a story. It's the reason why I also read stories. So, yeah, for me, I mean, I'm just interested in that idea of all the different ways, all the different people you could be if your circumstances were different. And so the book, of course, sort of peels back my main character, Tom, not just him, but other characters in the book, but especially him because we're experiencing the story from his perspective. You know, what can be stripped away from you and have you still be you? You know, how much of it is your just your psychology? How much of it is your, you know, your family, your personal experiences, your, you know, social circumstances, the history of your country, the history of the world around you. How much of that affects who you are, and how much of it of who you are is an essential thing. I mean, I think the reason why these questions of identity have always been really at the forefront for me is because of my family history. You know, pretty much every member of, you know, my grandparents, my parents, radically changed their lives at one point and had their life take a real kind of swerve in another direction. And I feel like my life now is the result of these big, big choices, these hinge points in the lives of members of my family. You know, my grandfather was born in New York. He became a chemist. And during the war, he developed these ways of synthesizing vitamins, which proved crucial. You know, they would send them to they needed to send like artificially synthesized vitamins to the troops on the front because they couldn't get nutritious meals. So he didn't go to war because the work he was doing in vitamins was so important. You know, one of the things that they told him, he was actually he was approached about the Manhattan Project. He didn't know what he was saying no to. He just knew that there was this project in New Mexico that they were asking him to come join, but he felt his work in vitamins was so important that he wanted to stick to that. I would have had a very different life if he had made that decision. Mm-hmm. My grandmother, who grew up in Vienna, she had to escape on one of the Kinder transports during the Second World War. She had to escape the Nazis, and she became an au pair in England after jumping ship and eventually immigrated to the U.S., where she became an American citizen and met my grandfather in Chicago. But, you know, the war completely changed the life she thought she was going to have. My mom was an actress and moved to London in the late 60s, where she got a job at the Institute for Contemporary Art, just a day job while she was doing theater, and that ended up changing her life. She went on to become a curator and an art critic, and then she died, actually, unfortunately, when I was in my mid-20s, quite suddenly. But she was a museum director, and, you know, she had this whole life in front of her, and she had really changed her life from her days as a theater actress to a museum director and an art critic. And then, of course, her illness, which was diagnosed very late and took her very quickly, of course, changed, the lives of everybody in my family. My father as well. He was a lawyer. My father was born in Marrakesh, and like mm-hmm. Like a lot of people, he had to escape from Morocco during the war, and ended up in the French Alps before immigrating to Israel, where he ended up becoming a prosecuting attorney for the government and had this whole career there. Until one day, this woman walked into a coffee shop where he was eating lunch, and it was my mother. And she was just, you know, she was from North America. She was traveling. And they met, and if, you know, she had walked into a different coffee shop, or he had left a minute or two earlier, or she had arrived a minute or two later, they never would have met. They fell in love, and he ended up moving with her to Vancouver so she could do her PhD. In Canada, he didn't speak a word of English, and his whole career was based on a completely other legal. He couldn't even become a lawyer because it was a totally different legal system, and so his life completely changed. And I felt that growing up, that sense of like how. You know, my existence was a combination of giant historical forces that had nothing to do with me, wars and the Great Depression and, you know, these massive population shifts that came out of all this trauma, as well as a happenstance meeting between two people who would have had no other reason to meet. And so this is a very long-winded way of saying that I feel like my identity and my sense of my identity is very, very much kind of like based in this sort of combination of history and circumstance. So I think you probably feel that in the book as well.
Yeah. Wow. Dear God. That's It's amazing.
I feel like that was a really long answer to your question.
It's amazing. It's amazing. I was riveted. You should write this down.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up at a
You have like 80 books in there.
You know, in a house where literally every single person around the dinner table had a different accent. And so even though I'm born in Vancouver, I'm you know, Canadian born, and I have a funny name, I was very aware of the sort of, you know, the threads of history, and I sort of had that sense of how my life, my very small local life, fit into a much larger global picture.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Wow. My guest this morning is Ilan Mastai. The book is All Our Wrong Todays. Just getting into the mechanics of this a little bit, the chapters are very short. And so talk just about constructing it. This is your first novel after writing a lot of screenplays, and you know, touched on a lot of the differences in approach between third person present and first person. But talk a little bit about just the assembly of this book. If you wrote it from, you know, A to B to get the A to B to C to Z to get the story down, and then massaged it, or kind of how you approached it different than you would approach a screenplay. Talk a little bit about the structure.
Absolutely. Though, of course, when you're talking about a story that involves time travel, it's not A, B, it's not A to Z.
Yeah, right.
H, F, G, Z. The why. Yeah,
right.
I mean, as a writer, and this is different for different writers, but for me, I have to know my ending before I can really start. I don't start writing a story, whether it's a movie or a book, until I have a really strong sense of my ending. Now, of course, that may change as the sort of exploratory process of writing the book, especially the first draft, kind of progresses, but I'm somebody who has who feels like I can't really start writing until I know how I want the story to end. So I did have a good sense of that when I started. You know, like a lot of first-time novelists, I wrote this book on the side. I didn't have a literary agent. I didn't have a publishing deal. Nobody was asking me to write a novel. So I wrote it on mostly evenings and weekends. I did have a day job, which is a fairly uncommon day job, which is that I'm a screenwriter. And so I was spending my days writing, but I was writing movies and often under contract to different producers or studios and that kind of thing. This was a thing for me. I had this story that I wanted to tell, and even though I think it could make a great movie, I felt that the way I wanted to tell the story was as a sort of fake memoir of this wild adventure that the character goes on. So initially, the short chapters were, each chapter reflected a day's work. You know, I made a goal for myself as I would just write, if I could write 250 to 500 words a day, but do it every single day. And so I just carved out on evenings and weekends, every single day, half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour to work on just that little piece of the book. And I mostly wrote it sequentially. And so initially, each chapter reflected that. Now, after I got six or seven chapters in, it suddenly dawned on me that it was reminding me of Cat's Cradle, the Kurt Vonnegut novel, which is a favorite. I mean, Kurt Vonnegut's a favorite novelist of mine, and that's one of my favorite books by him. And so I went back and looked at Cat's Cradle again, and I hadn't read it in a number of years, but I realized that that a lot of the themes he's grappling with, and a lot of the sort of even the perspective of the novel was actually echoing a lot of things I was writing about, both in terms of the tone, which is sort of a balance between kind of comic observation and sort of bittersweet longing, and also just these themes about technology and science and the social and personal impact of them. And so I ended up writing, for anybody who reads the book, I sort of ended up writing, I mentioned Cat's Cradle and name drop Kurt Vonnegut sort of about, I don't know, you know, a few chapters in, because I realized, okay, well, if I didn't mean to imitate him, but I am, so I might as well wear my influences on my sleeve. And I started to really enjoy the short chapters. Now, part of that is for me, as a reader, I like short chapters because it makes you feel like, oh, I read a whole chapter, even though I only read a couple pages. Like, you get this feeling of accomplishment, but at the same time, I feel like it makes the book read faster, kind of like helps with your plot momentum. And that might be simply that as a screenwriter, I'm comfortable with short scenes, but I like that feeling of these bite-sized pieces of the narrative which keep you turning the pages. I mean, hopefully. It keep you turning the pages if you like the book. If you don't like the book, maybe it makes you throw it across the room faster. But
No. Yeah, I mean, I always look at books at the time they're born into, and you know, reading this over the course of the last week or so was just the perfect anecdote to, you know, to what's going on in the world. And you know, it's A, wonderful escapism. It's B, sort of a, you know, an examination of where we were 50 years ago, where we thought we might be and where we actually are. And like I say, all these interesting questions about identity and how we're shaped and the influences we're shaped by, which is heavily on my mind these days.
So it's
really firing on a lot of really interesting cylinders. And I think you can't take a book out of the context of the, you know, the time that it comes out. And feels like the right book at the right time.
Well, that's kind of you to say. I mean, I think that as a novelist, you're writing about your personal interests, but inevitably you're also a product of history. And so, of course, I finished this book before a lot of the, you know, major political and cultural shifts of the back half of 2016 kind of propelled us into this very sort of unknown 2017. But at the same time, obviously, I'm as much a part of all these sort of like eddies and flows of culture as anybody else. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, as a writer, it's an interesting thing because the book is a very personal thing when you start writing it, especially as in my case, as in a lot of first-time novelists. You know, I didn't have a book deal. I didn't have a literary agent. I was writing it for myself. And then you start this process of handing it over to the readers who will, you know, hopefully connect and are inevitably going to interpret the book through their own personal lens. I mean, that's part of the fun of writing a book, but it's also part of the challenge as a novelist of letting it go. You know, everybody's going to interpret it the way they want. And I think in kind of current political circumstances, that that shift is even more stark.
Right, right. We're drawing down on our time, but one quick question about when you don't have a book deal and you don't have an agent for literature, but obviously you had connections in the screenwriting world. Talk a little bit about getting the book into the world and, you know, finding your agent and kind of the logistical part for our listening writers out there.
Oh, sure. I mean, look, I don't want to set myself up as just like, oh, you know, I'm just this person who had, you know, didn't know anybody and had no connections and it just came out of nowhere. I mean, I've been a screenwriter for a number of years, so I actually didn't really know anybody in the literary community, but because, you know, there's so many books get turned into movies, I was able to kind of go the opposite way, which was like talk to some producers that I knew who had worked with certain novelists, certain literary agents, and get recommendations and people whose work they, you know, who agents who they really respected and who were good to work with. And so I was able to find a great agent by working through some of the producers that I knew and who I had worked with. And I think the fact that I was a screenwriter intrigued my agent before he read the book. And then, you know, I think still fundamentally, you still have to write a good book. Right. And I do think that there's a lot of, obviously, imagination to go on trying to get a book deal, but fundamentally it is still the work. If you write a book that excites somebody, that they're going to get excited about it, and they're going to be interested in helping you get it out into the world. It's been a real learning experience for me. I mean, there are a lot of similarities between movie business and the book business. One of the things that actually really knocked me out, I have to say, is that people in the book business like really love books in a way that actually isn't always true in the movie business. I mean, there's a lot of people who are incredibly passionate about movies who work in the movie business, but there's also a lot of people who you sort of feel like, when was the last time you actually saw a movie? And in the book, and what I found, even just what we're doing right now, like you're asking me very interesting and astute kind of questions about themes in the book and about my life, and those aren't necessarily questions that I would ever get asked about a movie that I wrote. So it's actually quite heartening to know that.
That's funny. Well, I loved it. It's like I say, it was a wonderful antidote to what's going on right now, and it was just a complete pleasure. So thank you so much, Ilham Nasai.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Huge pleasure. I wish we had more time because I have about 30 more questions, but as it goes,
I answer every question with like a 45 minute long.
I love it. Thanks again. That was Ilham Nasai. The book is All Our Wrong Todays. It is out and available now. Very fun read. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.